From Odyssey, I'm Lauren Berry, and this is the On Deadline podcast, where we take a deeper look at stories from our radio newsrooms across the country. Today on Deadline is looking at a decision from the Supreme Court that will impact the 2024 election and potentially who we have as our president next year. 9-0. That was the tally that emerged from the Supreme Court after it heard Colorado's case that removed former President Donald Trump from primary ballots in the state. The Colorado Supreme Court disqualified Trump based on his actions on January 6, 2021, saying they put him in violation of the Insurrection Clause in the 14th Amendment. However, after hearing the arguments from the state and Trump's counterpoints, the United States Supreme Court ruled that the decision would not stand. Justices agreed the role of enforcing that part of the amendment was in Congress, not the states. Because the Constitution makes Congress, rather than the states, responsible for enforcing Section 3 against all federal officeholders and candidates, we reverse, the ruling said. One thing that was missing from the ruling was the court's thoughts on whether or not Trump's actions on January 6th did violate Section 3. And while the decision was unanimous, not every justice agreed on how it was written. To share more about what the justices felt about the case, Jason Marisam from Mitchell Hamline Law School in Minnesota joined Odyssey.
What was your reaction to this ruling?
Yeah, I mean, so you got the big picture right. Practical matter is it's 9-0 on this question of whether Trump can appear on the ballot. You know, the court rejecting these attempts to disqualify him based on his role in the Capitol riots on January 6th. And that's the big picture headline. But when you get into the weeds a bit, there are some disagreements among the justices that can signal that if we keep seeing some election cases down the road this year, those disagreements might be bigger. So it's 9-0 on the results. But when you get into sort of the reasoning and rhetoric, they weren't always happy with each other.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to have you on, because I read the ruling this morning and the dissent. Well, not the sort of the little addendums on each one. Right. And that's where sort of the interesting stuff comes in, where the liberal justices concurred in the judgment, but they seem pretty irritated at the majority opinion. Without like getting too much in the weeds, could you sort of help explain to our listeners like what that is about?
Yeah, so they all agreed that states themselves and state courts, which is how these petitions were coming up, don't have the power to disqualify someone from federal office like presidency. They could have just stopped there. But the majority went on to say, and here's how we think it would need to happen for the president to be disqualified. You need an act of Congress specifically getting at this issue. Oh, and by the way, we would review that act to make sure that it was tailored the way we wanted to, and it would need to do this and that. And the liberal justices said, whoa. We could have just stopped at what Colorado did wasn't good enough. That's all that was asked of us. And what was interesting, I found most interesting, is Justice Amy Coney Barrett trying to play the middle ground. She wrote separately to say
two paragraphs. She chimes in and it was like, oh, what's going on here?
Yeah, it was a real interesting signal. She says, look, I agree that the majority shouldn't have reached that issue. We could have ruled 9-0. But so she's chastising the majority. She also chastised the liberal justices to some extent to say, hey, it's an election year. Let's see if we can all try to get along on these big issues and as an institution, have the court play a temperature reducing role, which I think is interesting to watch going forward. She's potentially signaling that she wants to play that role of reducing the heat, if you will, in this election season.
Yeah, Amy Coney Barrett, who I guess as an outsider, you never really know what role these justices are going to end up playing as they sort of sort through. I'm sure it has some similarities to other workplaces as you sort of figure out, like, all right, what's my role here? How do I fit in with these other folks? Where am I going to be able to make a difference and have an impact? And she writes, the court has settled a politically charged issue in the volatile season of a presidential election. Writings on the court should turn the national temperature down, not up. And then says our differences are far less important than our unanimity. All nine justices agree on the outcome. That is the message Americans should take home. Is it unusual to have, I mean, that, you know, when justices are writing, are they thinking about, like, all right, what message are we sending to the American people?
Absolutely. And not always, right? Sometimes you have some totally wonky legal issue that's purely just for a certain set of lawyers, right? But on an election issue like this, on as big of an issue as the 2024 presidential election, they are very mindful of the signals that they're sending to the public and mindful of, you got to remember, these aren't elected officials. I mean, right. To some extent, their influence depends on people seeing them as having some faith in them. Even if they don't agree on a particular opinion, you have some trust that this is an institution that is really working for our democracy. So they're very mindful of that. And I think she's signaling that's, and to your point, figuring out what role you want, you know, as one of the more junior justices, that can take time. And I think it's definitely something interesting to watch going forward.
The overall precedent the Supreme Court set with its ruling is that removing candidates from ballots requires uniformity. Some experts have even said that the unanimous ruling comes as a preventative measure. If states could remove candidates from ballots, it could become a slippery slope amongst political opponents. As it pertains to the ongoing election cycle, the decision to let Trump remain on the ballot seems like a definite victory for the former president. Trump, who is facing 90-plus criminal charges, now has one less legal issue plaguing his campaign. But the Supreme Court isn't done with him. Next month, the court will hear another case involving the limits of his presidential immunity. Richard Hassan, a UCLA law professor who specializes in election law, joined Odyssey to share more on the positive and negative impacts this could have on Trump.
Last time you were here and you spoke with us, you basically predicted this result. Are you surprised, though, that it was unanimous?
Well, I'm not surprised at the result. I'm not surprised that the justices unanimously agreed that states can't, on their own, decide whether or not a federal candidate is disqualified. It was pretty clear from oral argument that's what they were going to do. But what did surprise me was that the justices, though it's unanimous, divided bitterly on some extra language that the majority put in about Congress's power to disqualify Trump, which is something that could come down the line if Trump actually appears to win the election in November.
Now, the court ruled the power resides with Congress to remove a presidential candidate from the ballot under the 14th Amendment. What's the justification for that? Why would it be up to Congress, not up to the states?
Well, the court said really two things. One is that the 14th Amendment, which was passed after the Civil War, was meant to shift power from the states, where some of the states had engaged in civil war, to Congress. And second, the court cited a kind of the patchwork of decisions, different standards. How would you judge whether someone's engaged in disqualification? For a national election, the court suggested this is not something that should be left to the states, but requires uniformity.
Now, the high court is also taking up the immunity case next month. How likely is Donald Trump to win again?
He's likely to lose this case. I think we'll have a better sense after oral argument, which is going to happen the week of April 22nd. The real question is not, I think, whether or not he wins or loses, because he's put together a kind of a really extreme argument that the president could do no wrong. He could end up being free from any criminal liability. But it might delay things so much on his criminal trial on election interference that the trial can't be held, or at least can't be completed before Election Day.
Polls currently predict that Trump would beat President Joe Biden in a hypothetical rematch of the 2020 election. A Wall Street Journal poll from Sunday found that 40% of voters would cast their ballots for Trump and 35% for Biden if the election was right now. So what would another 4 years of Trump look like? How would the country react? Derek Muller, a law professor at the University of Notre Dame, who is an expert on election law and the role of states in the administration of federal elections, joined Odyssey to share more.
If Trump is convicted in any one of these cases going forward and becomes president, how would that impact his ability to serve?
Yeah, that's a major question, a major open issue. Eugene Debs, 100 years ago, received some electoral votes while he was an incarcerated felon. Not electoral votes, but popular votes, around 3% of the vote as a socialist candidate while he was incarcerated. But we've never gotten to the point of thinking about somebody elected from jail or from who has this pending conviction. It raises a number of questions. You know, one major question has been, can a president pardon himself? It's been an unanswered question. And I think, you know, if you become the president, you would try to pardon yourself, and that would be its own sort of crisis. But you can't pardon yourself if you are convicted of state charges, which is something that might happen in Georgia or New York, although I think less likely there. And then we have sort of a structural question. Can a state incarcerate or hold on to an elected federal official? And there's some cases stretching back a couple hundred years suggesting that states can't do that. But, you know, I think there's major issues about how we think about it in this context, where it might be before an election, where the candidate was serving from a criminal conviction rather than somebody trying to remove an office holder or something like that. So these are the kinds of scenarios that we don't want to see, you know, the disaster scenarios in the future and open questions, to be sure.
But as a practical matter, I can't envision Georgia state troopers going to the White House and asking the Secret Service if they wouldn't mind if we arrested the president and took him to Georgia.
No, that's right. That's right. I mean, I think this is why there's such intense pressure, as you've seen Jack Smith in these January 6th cases, to get these cases resolved before the election, not just before the election so the voters know, but before the election to prevent this precise kind of mischief, you know, the kinds of questions about how state law interacts with someone who's sitting in the White House. So I think this is why there's such a time crunch on a lot of these issues.
With regards to the election and a timing of a conviction, as you mentioned, it could happen before. If that does happen before, how would that shake things up? I mean, is Nikki Haley smart to be staying in the race?
I mean, you know, there's nothing in the Constitution that prohibits someone who's convicted of a felony or someone who's incarcerated from serving as the president. So it's not exactly a situation we want to be in. There's also no question, I think, that every time Trump's been indicted, it seems that his popularity, at least with the Republican base, seems to grow. But at the same time, there might be a bridge too far for some independent voters who are sitting there and saying, look, I can take some of these shenanigans, or I'm concerned about Joe Biden's age and health and well-being, but there are certain lines that are too much for me, including being convicted of a crime. And, you know, I think, though, the Republican Party is not interested in making substitutes. Right? They're not interested in trying to adjust the political process. You know, if Republican voters want Trump, I think the RNC is going to, you know, be very happy to do whatever its voters have indicated. And so even if that means a conviction, I think it means standing by him with whatever chaos that might come from that.
President Biden has discussed what seems to be the inevitable rematch with Trump more frequently as of late. During a sit-down with Evan Osnos of The New Yorker, Biden shared his trepidation about Trump actually conceding if he loses the next election. "Losers who are losers are never graceful," Biden said. "I just think he'll do anything to try to win. If and when I win, I'll think he'll contest it, no matter what the result is." But with 8 months until the election, much remains to be seen about who will be on the ballot and what the outcome will be. This show is produced by Joe Heedy, Christy Strouser, and Myron Kaplan. I'm Lauren Berry. Thanks for listening to On Deadline, Odyssey's serving of a top news story just for you. Subscribe on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts to stay informed.